This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Hi, how's it going? On the report, well, Valentine's Day this week, so we've got a love story for you. Setting the mood for frogs and toads. Zoos go to great lengths to get amphibians on the brink of extinction to, hook up. And people who love their old houses fight the winter when their homes are like drafty old barns. And there's a lot of talk about new cars that pollute less and get better gas mileage, but where are they? When will we actually see more of them on the dealer showroom floor?
You've heard of it before. It's a hybrid. And it seems like everyone says they want one. They say they do.
I live in the world where I don't deal with what people say they think. I live in the world where they write the check.
Those stories coming up, but first, here are some of the stories we've been following this week. A federal court says the Bush administration's plan to put a cap-and-trade program in place for mercury emitted from power plants and other coal-burning smokestack industries is a no-go. Cap-and-trade programs allow polluting plants to buy pollution credits from cleaner plants. The overall pollutant is reduced. The Environmental Protection Agency has cap-and-trade programs for other pollutants, but mercury is different. It settles out pretty close to the plant, so you'd end up with mercury hotspots. Since mercury is a neurotoxin, it can pollute waterways and get into fish. That's bad for everyone, but especially bad for women of childbearing age because it can cause problems for developing fetuses and small children. The EPA can either appeal to a higher court or come up with some other mercury pollution reduction plan. Critics say President Bush is trying to block part of a new law that makes the government more accountable. The Open Government Act is supposed to improve access to government information. But as Mark Brush reports, the Bush administration's recent budget request attempts to strip a key provision of the new law.
The new Open Government Act tries to address complaints about government secrecy by creating an impartial mediator, an ombudsman who will help resolve disputes over information requests. But in his budget, President Bush calls for the elimination of the new ombudsman. Rick Bloom is the coordinator of the Sunshine and Government Initiative. That's a collection of news media groups working for a more open government. Bloom says having an impartial mediator is critical to resolving disputes.
Right now, if you get denied, if an agency says, no, you can't receive this document, well, your only recourse is to hire a lawyer at tens of thousands of dollars or maybe even over $100,000 to pursue a legal case.
Bloom says he's hopeful that the president's attempts to eliminate the ombudsman position will not stand. For the Environment Report, I'm Mark Brush.
So you might be thinking about getting your Valentine some flowers this week. But many store-bought flowers are not as rosy as they appear. They're often grown in other countries where the flowers are treated with pesticides that are banned in the U.S., Kyle Norris reports on a new kind of flower certification that's trying to deal with that issue.
There's a new certification for flowers called Flor Verda. It's not an organic certification, but environmentalists say Flor Verda is a step in the right direction. Craig Manoa is an environmental scientist with the Organic Consumers Association.
It requires roughly half the pesticide use. You can only use the pesticides that are legal here in the United States, and the farm workers need to be given a fair wage and worked standard hours.
Manoa says lots of companies are jumping on board with the new certification. Dole, the big pineapple and banana company, is the biggest importer of cut flowers in the United States. The company recently announced their entire line of Colombian-grown flowers will have the new certification. Manoa says lots of flower stores and supermarkets will be carrying the Flor Verda certified flowers. For the Environment Report, I'm Kyle Norris.
This week, February 15th through 18th to be exact, scientists are hoping you'll help them with a project. Rebecca Williams reports all it takes is 15 minutes in your backyard.
The Great Backyard Bird Count is a huge four-day bird watch. It's a census of all the birds at backyard feeders in the winter. You look outside, watch birds, make a list of what you see, and send in your results online. It's a project of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and the National Audubon Society. Pat Leonard is with the Cornell Lab. She says it's okay if you're not an expert birder.
I think people probably know a lot more of their backyard birds than they realize. So if you know a dozen species, you're pretty much set because that's what we're looking for.
Leonard says her team could never get as much data as they do without the backyard bird counts. She says over time, they're able to see long-term trends, such as how climate change could be making some bird species stick around longer in the winter. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Speaking of birds, a conservation group says birds would get much-needed help from President Bush's proposed federal budget. Chuck Quernbach has that story.
The National Audubon Society and other organizations have been warning that many bird species are in decline because of threats such as loss of habitat. The president's budget would put $36 million more into wildlife refuges. There'd be another $8 million for keeping track of bird populations and helping migrating birds. The Bush administration is often focused on birds that are hunted. Greg Butcher is with the Audubon Society. He says the budget initiative would help wetlands birds.
Going to include ducks and geese that are hunted, but it's also going to include herons and terns and other species that aren't hunted. So it's a very habitat-focused initiative.
Congress still has to act on the president's budget. It contains many controversial items, so that could delay final passage. For the Environment Report, I'm Chuck Quernbach.
We're always hearing about new gadgets, and this one's kind of interesting. Companies are starting to add solar panels to everything from portable electronics to the bags we carry those gadgets around in. Brad Linder reports on the latest trend in portable solar power.
Voltaic Systems sells solar-powered backpacks and messenger bags. Each bag has a solar panel on the outside that can charge gadgets such as cell phones and MP3 players. It can also charge an internal battery, so you have electricity even when there's no sun. But CEO Shane McQuaid says the solar panels are often enough.
We've got 4 watts of solar power on the outside of the bag, and it's probably 3-4 times as much as most little solar chargers have. And what that means is you can basically just plug it straight into the panel, stand in the sun, and make a phone call.
Voltaic Systems bags cost between $200 and $250. The company admits that's far more than a typical backpack. Voltaic Systems is also preparing to launch its first laptop case this spring. For the Environment Report, I'm Brad Linder.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Well, how about a love story? You've heard about the princess kissing the frog to find her Prince Charming, right? Well, what's wrong with a little frog kiss just between frogs? There are thousands of kinds of frogs and toads that could go extinct in our lifetime. Rebecca Williams reports zoos are trying to save the most endangered frogs by playing matchmaker.
Okay, so we're in our Panamanian golden frog room.
This is the frog bachelor pad. The lights are low. One of the girls is sitting naked under the waterfall. And in a dark corner of an aquarium, there's some action.
Well, the male has clasped onto the female around the back.
Dana Schock is like Dr. Ruth for frogs. She's the curator of frogs and toads at the Detroit Zoo. Right now, she's trying to get these little yellow and black frogs in the mood.
They were just put together a couple of days ago. We're not sure they're feeling it yet. I don't know if we need Barry White music in here or what.
I love you, baby. I love you.
Getting the mood right matters because frogs are sensitive. The temperature has to be just right. Sometimes what the male wants is just not what the female wants.
Right there. You like it, right?
Dana Schock wants these guys to have lots of babies. That's because frogs are in big trouble in the wild. They're disappearing really, really fast.
The extinction going on is really of the scale that happened at the end of the Cretaceous when the dinosaurs went. But that extinction took place over 1 million years. We're seeing some of this go down in my lifetime. This is unprecedented.
As much as half of all amphibian species on Earth could go extinct in our lifetime. Here's why. Frogs and toads breathe and drink through their skin. Those thin skins make them very sensitive to pollution from farms and industry and whatever we put down the drain. Also, the places frogs live are being paved over for parking lots and subdivisions. Then, there's another really big problem. There's a disease sweeping through frogs around the world. It's called chytrid fungus. It can kill frogs in just a few weeks. Kevin Zippel is the program director for Amphibian Ark. It's kind of like Noah's Ark for frogs. It's a group working with zoos to save the frogs and toads that are most at risk, especially the ones dying from chytrid fungus.
The only solution for those species that are susceptible is to bring them into captivity as a stopgap measure until the day when we do have a cure for it.
Zippel says chytrid fungus was first found in the 1930s in the African clawed frog. That frog was exported around the world for medical research, and scientists think the disease was spread with it. Kevin Zippel says they're scrambling to bring frogs into zoos before they're wiped out. He says it's always much better for frogs to live in the wild. But he says for hundreds of frog species, taking them into zoos is the only way to keep them alive. The Wyoming toad is one species that's been saved by zoos. For all practical purposes, it's considered extinct in the wild. Zoos around the country have taken in the toads and gotten them to mate. At the Detroit Zoo, there's a special quarantine room. It's under lock and key. We have to disinfect our shoes so we don't track in bacteria or other diseases. Then Dana Schock lets us peek in on her babies. These Wyoming toadlets are about the size of gumballs.
These guys are fabulous little creatures. These are not divas. They're just such a pleasure to work with. They're fun and they eat well and just little Buddha bellies on them.
These little Wyoming toads have big lives ahead of them. A lot of sex. And their babies might get released back to the same place where they got their name, Wyoming. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has been releasing toad eggs and tadpoles in a few protected areas there. Brian Kelly is with the service. Last summer, for the first time in 10 years, his team found new Wyoming toad eggs in the wild.
It's incredibly encouraging because that's why we're doing this. We want to establish populations that maintain themselves and remain viable over time.
Kelly says the toads are still in trouble. Their habitat has to be protected, and the fatal chytrid fungus is still a major threat. So zoos will have to fill the gap for a while. It's not ideal. It costs a lot to keep frogs at the zoo. There isn't enough room in zoos to save every type of frog. And as Dana Schock at the Detroit Zoo will tell you, it's tough to figure out exactly what the frogs want. But she says she's not going to give up.
I'd rather go down flailing in flames. At least we can say we tried. And there are reasons to be optimistic. We have had successes. And they're scattered and they're patchy, and we learn from our mistakes all the time.
Schock says it would be much better to solve the frogs' problems in the first place. She says that means not paving over all the wetlands. It means not polluting ponds and creeks. And hopefully, finding a cure for chytrid fungus. For the Environment Report, I'm Rebecca Williams.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, we'll hear about drafty old houses and the people who love them. But first, we're hearing a lot more from automakers these days about new technologies that'll save you gas, maybe even save some emissions. But most of the technologies they talk about are not in showrooms yet. So when will they be? And which technologies will find their way to your car first? Dustin Dwyer has a few answers.
There is already one kind of car out there that will save you a lot of gas. You've heard of it before. It's a hybrid. And it seems like everyone says they want one. They say they do.
I live in the world where I don't deal with what people say they think or what they give to a survey. I live in the world where they write the check.
That's Mike Jackson. He's the head of the country's largest chain of car dealerships, AutoNation. Jackson is pretty much the prototypical no-nonsense businessman. He's also somewhat of an unlikely environmentalist. But Jackson doesn't have much faith in today's hybrids.
70% of our customers want to talk about hybrids when they walk through the door. They're aware of it, they think it's a great idea, and they're predisposed to buy hybrids. You then get them at the table.
Jackson says that's when the customer asks how much extra the hybrid costs and how long it takes to make that money up by saving at the pump. That's when the deal falls apart.
And we have a 2% closing rate.
Jackson says, plain and simple, most people just aren't willing to pay the extra money to get a hybrid. So he says, to really cut gas use, the industry still needs mass market solutions. And the first technology that he's looking out for is something that Ford announced earlier this year. Ford's chief marketing guy, Jim Farley, calls it EcoBoost.
Which uses direct fuel injection and turbocharging to get big engine power and all that low-end torque we love from smaller, inherently more fuel-efficient engines.
Direct injection and turbocharging have been around for a while, but mostly as a way to make cars go faster. Now the idea is to use them on small engines so that when a customer comes in and wants a big, powerful engine, Ford can give them EcoBoost, which promises the same power with 20% less gas and 15% fewer CO2 emissions. Ford plans to put EcoBoost in more than 500,000 cars per year within the next 5 years. In that same time frame, you can also expect to see more diesel engines coming out from all the automakers. Diesel will get you better mileage, and it's now cleaner in some ways than gasoline, but it can create more smog-forming gases such as nitrous oxide. Ethanol is also still out there, but at best, most people say today's corn ethanol really doesn't save any fossil fuels when you look at what it takes to raise the corn. So the big hope is cellulosic ethanol, which can be made from grasses or even used tires. Nobody's found a good way to make it yet. And Mike Jackson, the no-nonsense car salesman, says he's not holding his breath. Instead, he's looking for the real game-changer, hybrid vehicles that can be charged through a wall socket and run on electricity alone for miles before a gas engine has to kick in. Jackson expects those plug-in hybrids on the road within 5 years.
The cost-benefit ratio is going to be so compelling, and people are going to be so enthralled at the idea they don't have to go to the gas station, just go home and plug it into the socket. This will win over with American consumers.
The auto companies are scrambling to make a plug-in hybrid. Right now, the race is basically between General Motors and Toyota. Both say they might be able to build a plug-in hybrid by 2010. The problem is the battery. To get the higher charge, hybrids need a new kind of battery, something called a lithium-ion battery. It's the same kind of battery, it turns out, that's used in your cell phone. But there are some challenges scaling that up for an automobile. Lithium-ion batteries can overheat, and right now they're more expensive than the batteries in today's hybrids. But Bob Lutz at General Motors says you can bet those problems will be solved.
Every manufacturer in the world is hot on the trail of lithium-ion technology, and the battery manufacturers all say it's going to work.
And once you have viable lithium-ion batteries, you're talking about cars that can get more than 100 miles to the gallon or better. Most people say the next step is hydrogen fuel cells. With the fuel cells, you put hydrogen in, and the only thing that comes out of the tailpipe is water vapor. Some in the industry say fuel cells could be ready for the mass market in the 2020s. Mike Jackson isn't so sure. He pegs the arrival of fuel cells at somewhere between not in our lifetime and never. For the Environment Report, I'm Dustin Dwyer.
This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. You know, people who choose to live in historic houses tend to appreciate old-world charm, but that charm often comes at the expense of energy efficiency. Old windows and doors let in cold drafts and leak out warm air. So homeowners are often forced to balance their interests in historical integrity and aesthetics against their environmental principles. Diane Richard has more on that.
My neighbor, James Boyd Brent, had me over to his house the other day. He lives in a beautiful farmhouse that's about 130 years old. It's got tall ceilings, rickety staircases, original windows, floors, and doors. But what makes it cool also makes it cold. Really cold. James recently had an energy audit done. Today he's showing me all the problems he needs to fix. He greets me at the door wearing a knit hat. And even though he's lanky, he looks a bit padded.
I got a vest, you know, like a t-shirt, a shirt, a very thick shirt, actually, and then a sweater and another sweater. So this is four layers.
That's because it's really cold inside. James is a professor of design at the University of Minnesota. He has a taste for beautiful old things, but that puts him in a bind. Does he sacrifice what he loves about his old home to improve his green cred, or does he simply live with the howling gales blowing down his hallways? It's a dilemma he confronts every winter. Preserving aesthetics versus conserving energy. He says it's not a strict either-or, and he's willing to install modern conveniences when it makes sense.
I'm not interested in being faithful to some sort of bourgeois idea about what history is.
To prove it, he shows me the ultra-high-efficiency furnace and water heater he recently installed in his basement. But I notice something else down here.
I see light coming through there.
That's Exactly. That's daylight. I mean, there's not even a window. There's nothing. There's just a hole.
Upstairs, it's bad enough. James's house rarely tops 60 degrees. Down here, though, I can see my breath.
Last year, you know, it froze down here. Rolex's cat water froze solid. I saw her once sort of tapping it with her paw with a look of sort of irritation.
We leave the basement and its gaping hole for another day. Today's chores start in the kitchen.
Okay, well, I'm going to, first of all, go in here. I'm working on this door here. Actually, as you can see, you know, I've sort of sealed this all around in layers, actually. But I've just decided it's not enough. I'm still letting air, great, you know, currents of cold air coming through. So I'm going to, I'm actually just going to seal the whole thing right on the outside here. Yeah, I'm just sticking that down a bit more strongly at the bottom. Because actually that's where all the cold air is coming through.
The energy audit helped James figure out where he was losing the most heat. Windows, doors, baseboards, walls, and attic all are culprits.
The basic thing is, you know, that's what came out of the energy audit, that all of this sort of stuff that I'm doing now is basically the sign of a complete loser.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean in the sense that, you know, it's just taking up all my time, and it's, you know, it's like I might as well live in a shack.
James is not alone. Lots of people are in the same fix, loving their beautiful old home, hating that it's as drafty as a barn. I talked to Paul Marin about James's frustration. Paul is a home energy expert. He says that taping sheets of plastic over old doors and windows should pay off.
That really reduces the amount of air infiltration and also adds another insulating layer. So that's very effective.
Paul says that there's lots more James can do, but taping up things is cheap and easy. Now, James is not exactly looking forward to pulling down all that film next spring, but he's willing to do it because it's the one way he can balance his appreciation for the past and his commitment to the future.
I mean, obviously, I could heat this house just by cranking up the furnace and not worrying, but it would cost literally thousands of dollars a quarter, you know. And also, it's just a complete waste of energy. You know, I do actually have a sort of sense of the connection between wasting money and also wasting energy and wasting resources and being wasteful.
So, like a lot of people who love their old homes, James's weekends will be spent sealing up his house. It's that, or spend a lot of money on expensive upgrades, or wasting money on heat that escapes through the drafty doors and windows, and that big hole in the basement. For the Environment Report, I'm Diane Richard.
And that's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. Shopping around for organic chocolate, pesticide-free flowers, and recycled paper so I can make my own card. I wonder if she'd mind crayon and a scrap of cardboard.
Oh, thank you. That was so sweet. What is this?
It's my Valentine's Day card. I made it myself.
Ah. Are you sure you didn't hire a 4-year-old to do this?
Okay, maybe I'll go to Hallmark. Mark Brush is my co-editor. He's still wondering what national security has to do with access to information about polluters. Rebecca Williams is our chief reporter. She's our resident frog counter. She's got a thing for amphibian mood music, too. We've got photos of frogs in love, sealing up old drafty houses, and more information on all the stories you heard today at www.environmentreport.org. And if you want to drop us a line about your Earth-friendly Valentine's Day, your own prints of a frog, or what kind of green car you're just dying to drive off the car dealer's lot, or if you just want to let the slackers around here know about a story we should be covering, our email address is feedback@environmentreport.org. The Environment Report is a tiny little division of Michigan Public Media.
Support for Environment Report stories comes from the USDA's Cooperative Extension Service, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, and the Americana Foundation. Get more information about Environment Report stories at environmentreport.org.